Hello neighbours, welcome to Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. I'm Ivan Emke, your host. This is episode 22 of season 2. Broad social changes, including enhancements in food production, take root at the individual and household level. That's what matters in the end. Sure, waving banners and marching and chanting slogans and wearing t-shirts and applying bumper stickers, it's fun and all, trust me. But to make a social movement stick, it has to be something that prompts changes at the level of our daily life in our own homes. Today, we speak with one household where that has happened, a home that has become a homestead.
Somehow, over a period of 70 years, we shagged it all up. We became dependent on a food system, a fuel system, an energy system that we have no control over anymore. There's been a big drive, I would say, on my side to become food secure in areas that I see we've had issues. Yeah. You know, people say, oh, it's great you got free eggs, man. Like, the place where those hens are living, like the hen Hilton there, like, that wasn't free. Like, I'll never get my value in eggs out of that thing. You know, you kind of need some sort of energy independence, so you're not a slave to a light bill. You kind of need to have some sort of food independence so that you're not a slave to, you know, the supply chains.
We've met David Goodyear before on this show. He's a physicist by training, and he applies that experimental ethos to growing food, using the power of nature's active and passive energy. His home has become known as the homestead at Flat Rock, where he lives in his passive solar house, with his earth-sheltered greenhouse, his raised beds, his root cellar, and more. Every year, he continues to expand on his homestead's own food security. He's adding new crops, new techniques, and, well, it was bound to happen. He's added chickens as well. I talked with David on Zoom earlier this year, in the midst of his second winter with his greenhouse. I started out by asking him what he was eating fresh out of his greenhouse today. It was late January at the time.
Oh man, so much stuff now. Like, it doesn't stop for us. It goes through the whole year. So you're just switching up from one season to the next. Like, it took me a year really to get that process down. But basically in the fall, I start succession planting seed trays for things like arugula, things like mizuna, various types of choys, bok choy or pak choy. I do a Meking choy, which are kind of like a brassica, like Chinese green that's good for stir fries and whatnot. This year I started growing a new one, which is called Fun Gin. That's a type of kind of a leafy mustard, and it grows super huge. It grows so amazingly quick, and it doesn't seem to care a whole lot about those dark days of winter. It just weathers right on through. Actually, I was out there today and realized that one of them is actually to the point now where it's actually starting to bolt, so it's starting to send up a flower head. So it's spring now. It's spring in my greenhouse, and you know, winter really is only just starting.
But what's the temperature in the greenhouse?
Well, about an hour ago I was out there actually pruning some fig trees, and it was about 18 then and climbing. And I think that this morning I think it was somewhere around maybe 4. So like in the nighttime, the temperature gets down, but the greenhouse hasn't frozen yet. Like, it hasn't got to sub-zero in there at all. And there's no heat running. But yeah, Basically, you know, I'm operating almost kind of 2 climate zones south of here.
Yeah. Well, 18 is basically summer in Newfoundland, right?
Yeah. It's a comfortable summer, right?
Yeah. So you have would you call it an earth-sheltered greenhouse, or how would you explain it to people?
There are so many ways to describe it. I personally just call it, you know, my earth-sheltered greenhouse, but you go to Minnesota, they call them, I think, deep winter greenhouses. I think there it's probably the terminology makes more sense, though, because like their deep winters, like, are pretty cold, right, compared to what we have here. The benefit there, of course, is that in the winter, I think they're able to grow quite a bit more variety, mainly because they have lots of sunny days. Yep. So one of the issues here, at least on the Avalon for sure, is that, you know, a lot of our light fuse. Now, some plants love diffuse light, but when you're starting to get into diffuse light and short days, you really just don't have enough to promote photosynthesis. So, you know, it's more like a living refrigerator until you get to now. By the time you get to the end of January and you're getting longer days and stuff, you know, things are starting to actively grow again.
Is this your second winter with this greenhouse?
Yeah, this would be the second winter. So there's been some learning curves, I would say, to follow. And so there was a little bit of tuning that in the first year, and knowing when, okay, so when do I have to seed these things so that in December, let's say, I'm going to have viable trays that I can cut off? And those were kind of all questions I answered in year one. And luckily in year two, it was much easier.
So have you chosen specifically cold tolerant plants?
You know, the process for determining, I guess, what's going to go in that greenhouse, there has to be a little bit of thought put in it, because really you're never ever experiencing winter. You're experiencing basically three seasons. You're experiencing a really, really hot summer for Newfoundland inside. You're experiencing what I would say kind of like fall, and then you're kind of getting something like spring. In the fall of the year, the bigger challenge is that in September, when, let's say, my tomato harvest is completely done, most people's greenhouses, they're still getting tomatoes in October. By that time, mine are, but they're long gone. Those are a distant memory. Right? Yeah. But, you know, September's still hot here, and the greenhouse is still very warm. So, you know, you need to put some thought into, at the beginning, things that will kind of tolerate the residual heat of summer in those early fall months, and they won't bolt. The issue with most of these plants is that, you know, if you start growing them under certain conditions, they'll bolt. And then they're useless. You know, a lot of the stuff that I do grow in fall are heat tolerant greens that in general have a fairly broad temperature range for growing. And it just happens that a lot of that stuff, you know, they're Asian greens in nature, right?
Do you use any artificial light in the greenhouse at all?
So interestingly enough, light is really, I would say, the limiting factor. If you want growth, really what you need is light. So this year, actually, I did add a grow light. And yeah, it's made a huge difference in terms of the amount of growth that some of these plants had. So even though the temperatures seem low, you're like, well, it's like, geez, can anything grow when it's 3 or 4 degrees? Yeah, it can. Some of the things can grow quite well if you have basically supplemental daylight. And that supplemental daylight really just needs to be from, let's say, an hour before sunset to like 8 p.m. So basically in the winter, you're seeing from kind of 8 a.m. really is when your daylight starts until 8 p.m. at night. So you got basically a 12-hour day. But I have a variety of lettuce growing now called Salanova. And in the greenhouse, I planted side by side, one under light, one completely away from the light. And both, you know, are still alive and they're fine. But the one grown under light is about 3 to 4 inches in diameter bigger, and it's almost 4 inches higher. Mm. So it wasn't really a lot. You're adding now basically about 3 hours of supplemental daylight a day. But it's enough that, you know, things are actually actively growing.
You grow a fair bit of your food, so you might not have noticed as much as some people that there's this pandemic that's been going on. What's your observations in terms of how people have coped related to food?
There's still a big problem. You know, I think that there was a potential for it to go sideways really, really badly. When you start having major Canadian producers, let's say, of meat, have to close down plants, and you realize that Newfoundland produces very little of its own meat. Places like Cargill, I think, is the name one of the major companies. I mean, they close down, and yeah, you walk into Sobeys, and there ain't no meat on the shelves. That doesn't hit home until people come in and see it. And it could have went a lot worse, I would say. Now, we're not out of it. It could still potentially go very bad if we don't make good decisions. But that being said, you know, I've seen good things come out of it. I think that, take, you know, the Backyard Farming Facebook group, it's almost doubled in membership since last year. And oftentimes the questions from these people that are coming in is, I'm going to start growing. What should I grow? Because, I mean, they're new people. And the number of people that were asking those questions over the past year is unbelievable, which is good. Because, I mean, why do people have lawns in their backyard? I don't get it. There's all this usable space, and you could be growing stuff, even if it's only to get you through, you know, 4 months a year, or extend things into the fall. But I think, you know, in some cases, people do need an easy button. And I think that we'll see food production here more as people realize that their neighbors are doing it, and they see that, oh, wow, look, this guy's growing carrots next door. I wonder what that's all about. And people talk, right? Yeah. And I think it will catch on. So I think one of the good things that kind of came out of the whole bad thing was that people, I think, are seeing that there are issues in, I would say, the supply chain. And when I say supply chain, it's much deeper than just the transportation, right? I mean, the supply chain has a lot of facets, and I'm not sure that people really see that there are so many facets to that chain. And it only takes one small thing to muck the chain up completely. But overall, I would say that for us, it's been pretty good. My biggest fear was getting seeds. But luckily, luckily I had my seed order in back in the December before. I did have to order extra things and it was hard to get them. But for us, it was funny, like when we saw all this start to go down, and my wife was like, we need chickens. And I was like, I don't know, man, if I want to get into that, right? Like, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
So that being said, we now have chickens. And it was funny because having chickens and animals is kind of a natural extension of growing anyway. It does provide inputs for the garden. I'm glad that we did it. It is a bit of work, but, you know, we jumped on that. So last year, we acquired our own chickens. So we have a supply of eggs, and we got a dual-purpose bird, so we could potentially kill them, although they're probably worth more in eggs than they are to actually kill them. But beyond that, last year was the best production for potatoes so far. We grew almost 507 pounds. I'm not living on a huge lot. Basically, we had 100 to kind of 150 pounds of carrots, you know, kind of 100 to 150 pounds of all these other things that we store. And then along with the greenhouses, it's been a pretty productive year, right?
Can you think of a piece of music or anything that would...
My wife is more of a music listener. Now, that being said, I play guitar and I never do it for people. I always do it by myself. And some of my YouTube videos have a song in there that I've composed songs.
But, okay.
I don't really listen to a whole lot of music. I guess I'm just so busy, right? My wife's usually the music listener and I'm the thinker. So I'm oftentimes sitting there saying, you know, maybe we could turn that music down because I'm trying to...
As you see, David leaves the door open for me to choose the musical interlude. That can be unwise unless you like a bit of quirkiness. I was thinking about David's greenhouse and his obvious love for his plants, and I recalled some literature I'd read recently about music made by plants. Not the kind where you cut down a tree and make a guitar or a drum, no. These are synthesizers, which are connected to parts of plants, usually at least a root and a leaf, and they register the electrical variations taking place in plants, and they transform those changes into sounds. Curious? You're in luck. I have some examples. Let's start with a group of shoreline plants at sunrise. Next up, we have the noble mushroom. What do they sound like? Of course, plants often grow along with many other plants, so here's an example of the sound from a quartet of plants. And can the music of the plants be different when they're sick compared to when they're healthy? Well, here's some examples from the same species. The first is not doing well, and the second is healthy. See if you can tell the difference. Here's a cool piece. It's from an 800-year-old tree. It's finally able to tell the world its adventures. And here is what it sings. If plants make music based on electrical impulses that we can decipher, what about animals? So someone hooked up their equipment to a dairy cow. Here's what she sounds like. I hope you enjoyed those. Maybe someday they could become a soundtrack for David's greenhouse. Imagine the possibilities. Back to our interview now with David Goodyear of the homestead at Flat Rock.
Really hard to get a handle on how much self-provisioning actually exists in the province. And sometimes it hasn't been articulated that that's a part of the food security solution.
I don't think it's been articulated at all, really. I know that the Food Producers Forum now has kind of put together a map, at least, of community gardens and whatnot. And that's kind of, an honest attempt at providing a bigger picture of what's going on, let's say, at a public level. Because normally what we see is usually what's on the go kind of in terms of government funding and whatnot. But who knows? Like, there's never been a census on vegetable growing. going in Newfoundland. And it could be something that could be useful to give us an idea about how much food people actually do produce and ways to kind of boost that, whether it's through, home renovation programs even. You know, when you build a house, if you build a cellar at the same time, you get a home credit. There could be all kinds of ways to promote people to do these things. And sometimes the fact of the matter is that, people are limited by cost. But if given the option of credits, people often will jump aboard, especially if they've had those things on their mind. Take the renovation tax credit from last summer. I mean, it basically spent the whole budget for the tax credit in like the matter of like 2 months or something. It was crazy fast how quickly they just ran through this credit. So, there are ways to entice people, I think, to move forward. And I think that in some cases, a lot of people that would like to move forward can't move forward because they would like to have the storage facility on property. Or maybe there's a way to not only have community gardens, but also have community storage, whereby community projects could be centered around large, let's say, underground cellars for storing things that are grown in community gardens and whatnot.
When you built your root cellar, you sort of alluded to the fact that we could add a few new ideas to the root cellar to make it more efficient instead of trying to build a case around a refrigerator. What kind of things would those be?
Most technology in terms of root cellars are pretty well established. I mean, they're mostly about creating an underground environment that's similar to that in which vegetables normally grow. So you're talking about cold, high humidity environments similar to a refrigerator. Hence, I guess, why people move towards refrigeration. The beautiful thing, of course, about root cellars is that it doesn't take much actually to store vegetables. I mean, you just need to have it cool. It doesn't need to be super cold, although the colder it gets, the longer things store for. But really, climate control, I think, would be the bigger issue in terms of the generation of heat and whatnot. So, for instance, with our easy access to computer controls and whatnot these days, it would be fairly easy, I would think, to be able to come up with a ventilation system that basically operates passively. So like most root cellars you see, they have usually one or two vents. And there's a main vent that comes out of the roof, and oftentimes there's usually a small gap left at the bottom of the door. And oftentimes, the vent is somehow pointed towards prevailing winds, so that way it forces air through. And the amount of air that comes through is actually very tiny. It's not that much. You just need enough to kind of regulate that humidity level. Mm-hmm. And as long as it's cold and the humidity is right, then it's easy enough to keep things from spoiling. So you're just really borrowing the cold temperature from that earth, and that's now not an energy you need to worry about. It. The ventilation stuff is probably stuff that could be done off-grid, in fact, because some of the ventilation requirements are actually fairly small in the winter. So as long as harvests are pushed later, which you can do if you're using season extension, a lot of this stuff could easily be stored in a cellar kind of at the last minute. Mm-hmm. And then any energy that you could store from off-grid could actually be used to power things like fans for ventilation under cases where, let's say, you didn't have enough passive ventilation. There's ways to do this stuff. The technology is not new, right? Root cellars work as they do, but there could be ways that could potentially make them work better. And there are so many opportunities. Like, I feel like there's so many opportunities for research here, that I wonder sometimes why I actually get people from outside of the province, not in the province. I have had nobody inside of the province come and say, we would like for you, Dr. Goodyear, to take these controls or these, let's say, sensors, put those in a greenhouse, we're going to monitor the greenhouse for a year. And we're going to use that sensor data to figure out why it works the way that it does. But I've had people from New Brunswick do it. I've had people from New Brunswick approach me about putting sensors in my greenhouse for research projects, but I haven't had anybody here. We want to move forward, but I kind of feel that the people that are driving us moving forward don't really get that to move forward, there has to be research and money put into these things. And believe me, I'm not looking to make money out of it. Somebody wants to use my greenhouse for research purposes, I'm more than happy to help. Yeah. And likewise, even for sellers and stuff, like why do they work so well? And under what conditions do they work well? I feel that there are easily things that could be addressed inside of departments that are science-based, right? You know, we could easily come up with control systems and test these things out so that they become more mainstream and provide actual data to people.
There's the obviously the inspirational aspect when people find out about your greenhouse or root cellars and they're interested in it because it's a model that can happen in backyards. But you're right, the research piece too would add more, and I'm using my fingers as quotes, legitimacy or whatever, to the whole process.
The thing is that, you know, with everything that people do, there's oftentimes bias, right? I mean, maybe Dave Goodyear is biased. So yeah, it's fine. If I am, you can come and install your stuff, do your measurements. Let's move the research forward and see if this is something that's scalable. Yes. Because if it is, it's something worth putting effort into. If you can build a structure that's going to last 50 to 100 years, using the right materials, using good science, and using good construction details, then there's no reason not to put money into it. If food security is something that's at the top of your list of things to do, right?
Want to hear more plant music? Sorry, I couldn't quite hear you, but I think you said yes. Now remember, this music is not coming directly from the plant, but it picks up changes in electrical potential between the roots and the leaves of the plants. These are synthesized representations of the electrical variations happening in these plants. That's still amazing, right? So apparently, here is what a cannabis plant sounds like. A bit like Pink Floyd, don't you think? I'm not sure, but maybe one is supposed to be imbibing the plant while you listen to it? Instead of listening to greenhouse plants, let's listen to greenhouse operators. Here's David Goodyear playing some guitar. It's part of the soundtrack he uses on some of his Homestead at Flat Rock YouTube videos. Today on Fit to Eat, I'm talking with David Goodyear of Flat Rock in Newfoundland, Labrador, about the joys of self-provisioning.
Is there anything new you're going to try this year, like a new crop or a new technique?
Yeah. So interestingly enough, all driven by the pandemic is the never-ending quest to expand. So luckily enough, I do have quite a bit of land here that I can still use. And so this year, the plan is once again, start looking at things that can be used to store. So this year, we've kind of switched up some things a bit. And next year, we're going to switch things up again. So next year, we're going to be growing squash. So we have two varieties of squash that we're going to trial. And once again, that'll be kind of using the greenhouse to get things going, moving outside under row cover in June. So that way you can kind of, you know, extend that growth season back into June now and hopefully be harvesting that stuff kind of mid-September. There's been a big drive, I would say, on my side to become food secure in areas that I see we've had issues. For instance, like for us, it's always pushing the envelope in terms of the security of having certain things for longer. So like last year was a successful year growing various types of onions. We use a lot. We use basically one onion a day, let's say. So if you look at that, it's 360 a year. So the plan moving forward is to become self-sufficient in onions, self-sufficient in garlic. We're now already self-sufficient in potatoes, carrots, turnip, all that stuff. But we're adding basically two new types of onions. We're adding three varieties of garlic and we're adding squash, melons. We're going to be growing melons this year. So I got a spot in my greenhouse where I think that we can start growing melons. So last year I used greenhouse solely for peppers and tomatoes, but processing like 66 pounds of tomatoes like in a 1 month period, yeah, it wasn't easy. Like it was a lot of work. Some summer squash, which we'll be growing grown in the greenhouse, two varieties of cucumbers. We won't be adding any more animals this year. But I think that'll be enough to kind of keep us going.
There's an interesting interaction between greenhouses and the public in Newfoundland and Labrador. We love them, but we may not trust them. It's kind of our history coming back to haunt us. So I asked David about the public and community response to his earth-sheltered greenhouse.
It's got, I would say, good community response, mm-hmm. like at least from the perspective online. And I have had people reach out about the, for instance, the house that I built was recently, I work with an engineering student and a prophet of mine, and we actually published a paper on the energy. So that was actually published just before Christmas, mainly written by the master student. I was kind of more just one of the editors on the paper. Yeah, I mean, it's gotten good community response. And I feel like if the right people got their hands on it and saw the, I guess, the benefit of what it is that we're doing here and, you know, could really map out the structure and why it works so well. Well, I kind of have ideas about why it works so well, but proof of why it works so well and, you know, move forward with things like how can we make it better so that we can make it more cost effective, more scalable, all of those things, then it could be something, you know, that maybe you'll see communities that'll have earth sheltered greenhouses in locations that are well suited for. Maybe, you know, you'll see the government build larger scale facilities for expanding things like seed programs. Yeah, it's a good thing. I think that people just need to see it as a good thing and forget the stigma of the so-called sprung greenhouse.
Thanks again, David. I'll let you head off and do whatever it is you do next.
I'll make sure that the hands haven't been attacked by a weasel there now.
The lengths that people have to go to protect those hens.
Oh, well, you know, Ivan, it's funny, you know, like, you know, so when I built the coop, you know, I didn't foresee that we were going to have as many hens as what we had. So it ended up that the run is not quite big enough. Okay. And hens are funny animals, hey? Like, they're, you know, they're flock-based animals, but they're downright mean with this pecking order, right? And when they're in a situation they don't like and they're like dogs backed in a corner, they attack each other. Yeah. So before Christmas, I did have a major pecking issue that I was trying to take care of where basically they defeathered the bottoms of each other. Yeah. To the point where some of them had wilts and wounds that were bigger around than a tunium. They're absolutely mean, right? So then, you know, then you ask the question, okay, is it better for them to have the space and be hens in their normal environment, or is it better for them to be secure and killing each other? I think the answer is the previous. So yeah. I let them basically kind of free range on days where there's lots of snow on the ground. I just open the door. It gives them the freedom. If they want to come out, they seem to be calmer if the door is open. And then, you know, I just kind of let them be chickens. And if nature is something that, you know, decides, you know, this hen is going right for the, you know, the pot today, or, you know, the mink decides it's coming, then, you know, it's something, you know, it's like, okay, well, the hens were still just being hens. It's probably better, right?
How many do you have?
So we bought 12, thinking that at least two or three would die, right? Because they say that, you know, mortality on chicks can be high in some cases. So anyway, we end up with 11, and, you know, it's a good number. But, like, we produce more than enough eggs for ourselves. Like, we probably only need maybe 5 hens, I would say. But the neighbors love it. Co-workers love it. Now, don't get me wrong. The eggs aren't free. Yeah. You know, people say, oh, it's great you got free eggs, man. Like, the place where those hens are living, like, the hen Hilton there didn't, like, that wasn't free, right? Like, I'll never get my value in eggs out of that thing, right? But they're secure. They're happy.
Well, thanks, David, so much for taking time. And
all right, Ivan.
Thanks again. We'll talk to you again sometime.
David is a relatively new convert to food security, but he shows that it's possible to turn the ship of food dependence around. If you'd like to know more about David's homestead at Flat Rock, check him out on Facebook, YouTube, or Instagram, The Homestead at Flat Rock. And I expect that soon he'll be on WhatsApp and Pinterest and Snapchat and Flickr and TikTok.
Why do people have lawns in their backyard? I don't get it. There's all this usable space, and you could be growing stuff, even if it's only to get you through, you know, 4 months a year. But basically, you know, I'm operating almost kind of 2 climate zones south of here. That having chickens and animals is kind of a natural extension of growing anyway. It does provide inputs for a garden. I'm glad that we did it. actually, I grew a single fig on this year. One fig, but it was the most tastiest fig. I put it on Twitter.
This has been Fit to Eat, the Newfoundland Labrador Farm and Food Show. To listen to other episodes of this show or for more information, go to fittoeatnl.ca. The music for today's show was a variety of tracks produced by Plants with some help from human technology, as well as a rocking piece that David uses for some of his YouTube videos. Now note that no plants or animals were harmed in the making of these sounds. The theme music, Cluckold Hen, was performed this week by Lotus White. This is a production of Kitchen Table Communications. I'm Ivan Imke. Join me again next time. I'll be right here. Happy trails.
So it's spring now. It's spring in my greenhouse. And, you know, winter really is only just starting.